Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast. We are looking back at 8 games in the opening round of the NCAA Men's Lacrosse Tournament. Probably one of the most exciting weekends of the year for every college lacrosse fan, and certainly, this weekend lived up to its billing. We'll hopefully be able to speak with Christian Sweezy, who is on hand at Capital One Field at Bird Stadium to take in Cornell Big Red, upsetting the Maryland Terrapins. And then we'll whip around, talk to Mark Dixon, who is on hand for both of the impressive AQ performances. It's kind of what I've been referring to them as in shorthand, and then speak with Ryan Flanagan, who is down in North Carolina. Not the AQ games, as a matter of fact, he was talking about to covering some of the more impressive first-round matchups with Carolina Lehigh and Duke Loyola, the latter being a thriller, one of the more impressive games, tournament games that I think we've seen in recent memory. But we'll start first with Christian Sweezy. And Christian, I think the Maryland-Cornell game is a good place to start, not just by virtue of the fact that that was a game that was depicted on the cover of the May issue of the Inside Lacrosse magazine, because there was this expectation, and I think that it was relatively, you know, justified throughout much of the season, that these were two of the best, if not the two best teams in college lacrosse. And, you know, obviously by the time tournament selection came around, that had fallen a little bit short. But the fact of the matter was that, you know, coming into this game, a game that had, you know, so much tradition in terms of dating back to two programs that had their heydays kind of concurrently in the 70s, kind of moving forward now, here we are, in 2013, Cornell has had, as many kind of close but no cigar moments as the Terps have after Maryland has lost in the NCAA championship game the last two seasons. So that's just kind of setting the stage. But the fact of the matter was, this is a pretty one-sided affair, and that's the first question that I'm going to put to you. What did you see Cornell do that was so impressive that allowed them to put together a lead that they were able to sustain throughout much of the second half?
They were very efficient with their offense. You know, Rob Pinnell was able to make so many things happen. I mean, I think what the stat that John Tillman, the Maryland coach, came back to was ground balls, which were 43-29 to Cornell. There were red shirts everywhere. You know, every loose ball seemed to come Cornell's way. But once they got the ball, I was really impressed with how many good looks they were able to generate. You know, of their 31 shots, like 26 were on cage. Very high. So even though, you know, you look at that 16 for 31 is a high shooting percentage, but even shots on goal percentage was just through the roof against a pretty good defense. So that was what impressed me, was that Cornell was able to get almost everything they wanted. And even with Maryland switching the matchup on Pinnell and it's Goran Murray for the first half and Jesse Bernhardt for the second half, bumping down from long stick midfield. And what was funny was that in the first half, Pinnell had an extra man assist, but otherwise he had 2 goals and 1 assist against Murray and 2 goals and 1 assist against Bernhardt. So it'd be pretty even all around, actually.
Well, and obviously you're not going to win very many games. You're particularly not going to win very, very many tournament games by giving up 16 goals. But the fact is, on the other end of the field, you know, Maryland, 8 goals on 35 shots. You know, 11 of those shots came in the fourth quarter when they were trying to push tempo and kind of overcome a deficit. And the game also started to, you know, really kind of slip through their fingers at that point as well. But, you know, this is a team that was so impressive early in the season offensively, and their, shortcomings were pretty well documented over the course of the next, really over the course of the last month. To what degree would you attribute, you know, the stifling defensive effort or the poor offensive effort that Maryland had to what degree do you attribute that to Cornell, and to what degree do you attribute it to Maryland and their inability to make things happen in the offensive end?
Maryland, you know, it's funny. I mean, they were so good out of the gate, but, you know, when you go back and look at it, okay, they beat Loyola without Hawkins, and they beat Duke when Duke was still desperately unsettled in goal. And frankly, Duke had a few of those early season losses, Penn being another one who wound up, you know, not even making the NCAA tournament. So I think Maryland was number one. I certainly voted them number one. But it's such a long season, and I think Clint referenced it in his story. You know, if you and we've talked about this, too, all season, where you have to kind of have a hook and then a second hook and then a third hook. You know, if you come out of the gates and this is who you are it's just such a long season. There are so many tough games and so much film available, and the coaching staffs are so good that if you don't adapt, if you don't change, if you don't have a curveball or something to kind of switch up midway through, or if you can't, you know, it's sort of like boxing. Like Maryland, I thought, threw a very good punch early in the season. Some counter punches came back their way, and I'm not positive that they either that they had the wherewithal to come back with a plan B. You know, once their plan A got stifled, you know, that Hopkins game where they were 4-for-28 shooting, I think, and Hopkins just took away a lot of what Maryland wanted to do in transition. And from there, I think people sort of had a blueprint of how to stop Maryland, and did a pretty good job with it. So that was what I thought. You know, even a Loyola where Hawkins comes back, or a Hopkins or Guida comes back, regardless of how it turns out, at least it's something. You know, at least you have something to hang your hat on. We're going to be different in April or May than we were in March. And I'm not sure that Maryland ever really was. And that's not an insult. They were very good in March and February. You know, it's just sort of bad luck for them that they ran out of numbers and ran out of depth when the season mattered most.
And it's kind of interesting and impressive or surprising, you know, the fact that Cornell, who one thing, and this is the thing that struck out to me, in Rob Pinnell's post-game press conference, made comment to, I think he said that they have 17 seniors on that squad, and that's impressive. That says a lot about, you know, who they have to rely on, not just in games, but also in practice. And, you know, seniors this time of year, you read about it all the time. They're more invested. They're inherently more invested because they know that the end of the rope is coming. And so, you know, when it comes to depth, the point that I was getting at is that it surprises me that Cornell has, you know, depth that can potentially outdo a Maryland squad that has recruited as well as anybody over the last 4 or 5 years. That being said, you know, when you look at Cornell now, based on that performance, what they have going forward, turning their attention to Ohio State, who just beat Towson, what are your thoughts on the Big Red, how they stack up, not just in this matchup, but as a legitimate national title contender?
I mean, I think they match up pretty well. Obviously, Pinnell and Mock have a great two-man understanding, you know, and where Pinnell, even on that first goal, didn't pass the ball directly to Mock. He kind of threw it to a space, and Mock got there and finished. So, you know, and you know, it's funny, just over the weekend, I was watching, or before the weekend, actually, on Friday, I was watching the 2010 Notre Dame Cornell semifinal, and it was Pinnell and it was Mock. You know, it was funny, even back then they had a great understanding for each other. So fast forward 4 years, and you can imagine, you know, how good they are together, and they kind of make everything go. Cornell's midfield didn't really get going until Bernhardt bumped down to close defense and Earhart bumped up, and you know, Earhart's a good player, that's a little bit of an adjustment. And I thought that, you know, that was when Cornell got something out of their second midfield, and that was when they got goals from Busick and from English. So you know, I mean, I would still like to see a little bit more out of their midfield, but if they can force defenses to make changes and change game plans, you know, maybe the midfield was always going to be plan B once Maryland took, you know, put Bernhardt down, and then, you know, maybe that was what they said. Well, then, all right, midfield, this is your chance. So I think they're pretty adaptable. I think Matt Kerwick was a very good hire because I think he keeps them kind of light. I think, you know, that's a sort of serious place up there in a lot of ways, you know, academically, obviously, and in terms of lacrosse, the way they approach it is similar to how Johns Hopkins and Penn State approaches it, which is, you know, it's a deal. Like you have to be invested and work hard at it. And I think Kerwick is a very nice sort of change of pace. He's a little loosey-goosey, a little relaxed. And I think the players like him. I think the players have responded to that. So I think that helps, too. You know, when you look at that game, 16 seniors can go the other way. What if they're tight? What if you have 16 extremely nervous kids taking that field? And I thought that Kerwick you know, at least the theory would have greatly helped them to remain loose and to kind of remain calm in a huge game.
The you know, kind of takeaway from that for me is, as you say, balance. It's the thing that becomes so identifiable at this time of year, it seems. I remember, you know, just thinking back to last year and what, you know, Loyola was able to do at both ends of the field. Be it their defense turning back Maryland in, you know, the winning moments of their national championship win, or, you know, what they were able to get out of Lusby when Mike Sawyer went cold. You know, it's a combination of balance and adaptability, which are two things that you just addressed in terms of, you know, kind of Cornell's, you know, impressive acumen, what they've been able to utilize to get them this far, that sort of thing. And so now, you know, as you were able to take in, you know, some of these games over the weekend, were there any other things that stood out to you, maybe as strongly or more strongly than what Cornell was able to do, insofar as we move on to the quarterfinals? These are the things that you're going to pay attention to, the things you're going to look out for, the things you expect to see insofar as, you know, who's going to be playing a Memorial Day?
Carolina was the most impressive team I saw, and I was able to watch almost all, at least snippets of all eight games. But, you know, Carolina, I was able to watch in its entirety. And I thought Lehigh was pretty good going down there with a really good goalie, and the way Carolina was able to generate offense and able to generate some good shots and was able to ride, you know, they really jumped off the page at me. So I will always remember being up at Annapolis for the quarterfinals in 2008, and when Duke had just annihilated Carolina, they get 19-11, and, you know, Duke went on one of those 11-0 runs or something. And as people were leaving, the Carolina folks are saying, well, you know, enjoy the Final Four, but Duke is going to win this whole thing. And, of course, they didn't. You know, I think they lost the next week to Johns Hopkins. So it's never about kind of how a team looks in the first round. It's how they, you know, look going forward. And maybe Carolina played the best game it can possibly play. I happen to think that they'll be okay against Denver. But you never know. That's going to be a fascinating matchup. And but Carolina was the team, to answer your question, Carolina was the team that really jumped out at me. And I think going forward, Connor Bucic at Cornell is a kid. He was okay yesterday, but I think he's someone who could be really special. I think he could be a really good player, and he's getting a lot of attention. He's drawing the poll, but I still think that he might have something to say for Cornell going forward.
There's no question that if it were to come down to a Carolina-Cornell matchup at any point, well, I guess it's really only one possibility in terms of when that would be, it would be an exciting one, and certainly two programs that have long looked to get back to the mountaintop. So, you know, Christian, as a fan of history, I would imagine that there's a part of you that would like to see that happen.
I would. And you know, just these matchups in total, you know, even Notre Dame, their defense is terrific, and people are saying, oh, they've been playing poorly, which they have. But if you look at the goals they're giving up, you know, 9, 10, 7, that's not insurmountable goals. I just think their offense needs to get in gear a little bit. And I thought it was interesting to see Stephen Murphy on the first midfield line against Detroit with Foley pumping that to the second line. You know, I don't know that they have the horses necessarily, but they might. And with that defense, in that goalie, you're going to be in every single game. So if you're asking the defense to score more than 7, more than 9, or I'm sorry, offense to score more than 7 or more than 9, you know, I would not rule Notre Dame out, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I know they didn't look very good against Detroit. They haven't looked good in a couple weeks. But, with, you know, that rock-solid defense, you know, I think they're going to stick around in some games. And part of their offense's problems is because that's how they play. They like to play slow. They like to control the pace. They don't want to give you as many chances on their defense. So the offense tends to play a little bit slower. And, you know, maybe they get out of rhythm a little bit or you know, some things like that. But again, who's going to score more than 10 on that defense? Not many people. So I don't think people should sleep on Notre Dame either. I think they're going to be around.
Well, there it is. Christian Sweezy, thanks so much for your time, and we'll talk to you again soon on the Reflex Podcast.
Perfect. Thank you for having me.
And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast continues with Mark Dixon. Very, very busy man who was covering two games this weekend. First, Detroit's near upset over Notre Dame in South Bend on Saturday, and then the weekend nightcap as the Syracuse Orange outlasted the Bryant Bulldogs 12-7 in the Dome. And Mark, let's start with this Detroit game. It was crazy. I was traveling this weekend and wasn't able to see any of Saturday's games live, so you know, I commented on Sunday. It was so remarkable to me that the Detroit Notre Dame game was the one that I wanted to see the most when I, you know, got back to my DVR. I guess if you had to put your finger on one or two things that you felt like the Titans did best that allowed them to build an early lead, what would you say those things are?
I think the first thing is they played very loose. They were very relaxed. Their mantra, beginning with their game with Canisius, which was their last regular season MAC game, was party on. It is a team that Matt Holtz described as playing very tense lacrosse, and that led to a 2-9 record. They beat Canisius, qualified for the MAC tournament, and the rest is history. They won the two games there and advanced the NCAA tournament. So I think the first thing is they felt like they had nothing to lose, and they played very loose. Guys were playing air guitar in warm-ups, wearing American flag do-rags, just jumping on each other. Just looked they were really excited and happy to be there. And then from there, they just played with a lot of passion, and they weren't afraid of Notre Dame in any way, shape, or form. Damian Hicks dominated faceoffs. Jordan Halpe controlled the middle of the field. And then offensively, the attack just took the game to Notre Dame. Brandon Beauregard and Mike Burney, they were just firing from everywhere on the field. So I think the way they were in the warm-ups translated into the beginning of the game in the first three quarters, really. And they are, you know, they were on their way to shocking the world.
So between the American flag do-rags, the air guitar, and the party on, was this more Detroit Rock City or more Wayne's World, in your opinion?
I think it was a little bit of a combination of both. It didn't matter what song came on the loudspeaker at Notre Dame. The guys were jamming on the sideline. They were running around the field. It is, you know, it's probably a little bit more of a Wayne's World, a lot less formal, without all the makeup.
The you know, so Jordan Halpe is a guy that I'm interested in just because you know, you see players you know, of his stature put up ridiculous numbers, and then you want to see what they look like in person. And for a lot of fans, this is the lone opportunity that they really had to, as I think this was Detroit's first national TV game in program history. How did he match up to your expectations or meet what you were expecting to see from a guy who has such a prowess for causing turnovers?
Well, I had the privilege of covering him in the fall when Canada played Team USA out in Denver. He was on the roster for the Canadian national team. And then I got up close and personal with him back in February when I officiated the Detroit Navy game. So I was familiar with his prowess on the field. He's a long player, very long arms, uses that 72 inches of titanium to his advantage. He's very athletic. He's very efficient. He doesn't waste a lot of motion, a lot of energy picking up ground balls. And he's not your Jesse Bernhardt, Scott Ratliff kind of long stick mid, meaning when he picks it up, he leaves a trail of smoke behind him. He's not the fastest guy in the world, but he's very efficient. And the one thing that he does well, in addition to the rest of the Detroit defenders, is they have great trail checks. And they may, I don't know if they're getting beat clean or if they allow their attacker to get a step, but then they just, you know, they have beautiful trail checks and put the ball on the ground, hence the number one team in the nation in terms of cause turnovers. And coming into that game, you're like, okay, well, they play in the MAC, and they're playing teams like Siena and VMI, et cetera. So, but they were taking the ball away from Notre Dame, and Halpe was central to that. He really did a great job of controlling the middle of the field the first half of that game.
Well, and then, you know, you talked about the kind of tale of two games, and I've actually only been able to see the first, like, 2.5 quarters, and at that point I had to turn over to live action yesterday, and I'll finish up the game tonight, but it sounds like from what I, you know, people that I've spoken with that watch the game and, you know, what I've read, that Notre Dame, their turnaround, their sixth goal, fourth quarter, 6-0 fourth quarter, was really triggered by a 10-man ride, Matt Kavanaugh playing awesome offensively.
Yeah, and I don't want to ruin it for you since you haven't watched the rest of the game.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
You kind of got the gist of things. Notre Dame just came out. They're trailing 7-3. Offensively, nobody was running by their man. And the off-ball play was non-existent because Detroit was doing a great job of picking off passes and sealing off feeding lanes. But they couldn't handle Notre Dame's pressure. Notre Dame changed their philosophy, went to a 10-man ride, pressured the ball all over the field, and they didn't allow Detroit to even get, I think they may have had one or two settled offensive possessions in the fourth quarter. They didn't come until about 6 minutes left in the game. And Matt Kavanaugh was just dynamic, dodging from behind the cage, getting underneath his defenders. Detroit fouled a little bit, and Detroit just, they couldn't handle the pressure. And that defense that was so stout for three quarters, they got tired because they played a good nine and a half minutes worth of straight defense in that fourth period because of Detroit's inability to control the middle of the field and clear the ball. All of a sudden, the Titans couldn't clear, and Notre Dame was all over it.
It's amazing how quickly those types of things can kind of change tone, because from what I saw, it was Detroit's ability to control the middle of the field in the first little bit that allowed them to create some sort of separation. And I think that, you know, shifting gears a little bit to, you know, the second game of the weekend that you covered, that being the difference between Bryant, what they were able to do in building a 4-0 lead, and then, you know, Syracuse being able to, you know, control the tempo, control the pace of play as they reeled off an 11-3 last, I guess, you know, 53 minutes of the game. One of the things that, you know, so a constant was that Kevin Massa was winning faceoffs throughout the entirety of the game. I think that early, Brian was able to, from my perspective, Brian was able to get a little bit of an advantage in terms of, you know, taking advantage of some defensive lapses out of Syracuse, in scoring their first two goals, and then just two really nice goals from there. But, you know, and I think this is one of the things that I'm curious to your perspective on, because I think it's one of those things that you can sense when you're in the building. But the initial enthusiasm that Brian kind of mustered and generated based on their really high quality early play dipped a little bit, and that's when Syracuse started to continue to chip away. Kind of the opposite. It wasn't a dramatic shift. It was just, you know, Bryant's energy level just kind of, it was on a downward slope that was eventually at some point probably in the, either in that last goal in the second quarter or early in the third quarter passed by Syracuse. What was it like being in the building watching that kind of, that shift take place?
You know, it was interesting because I was surprised to find that there was only about 2,900 people in attendance. I mean, it sounded like there were like 6,000 or 7,000. That's how loud it was. And a lot of it was courtesy to the Bryant contingent that came along. There were a few hundred Bryant fans. They were loud. They stood on their feet the entire game. They had a player cut out, big heads of the players, and there was a huge sign saying, "Welcome back, Coach Pressler," obviously referencing Mike Pressler's return to the NCAA tournament, his first since 2005. So they just had a ton of energy and took advantage of some schematic things. They knew Massa was going to dominate the faceoffs. What they're doing is they're putting midfielders on attack, and then when Massa would win the faceoff, the long pole or one of the defensive middies would run to the attack zone, and then the middie would run up. And Colin Dunster scored the first goal of the game kind of that way, coming in from the box because of the substitution pattern. They had a violation against Bryant. So they were able to pull the wool over Syracuse's eyes a little bit, and then they gained some confidence and started really clicking offensively. What Syracuse did was they called timeout, they regrouped, they scored a couple of quick goals, and then they really kind of regained momentum. And it was a slow process. It was a little glacial in its way because Detroit was not able to win faceoffs in the fourth quarter against Notre Dame. Nick Osello was giving the Irish to make it take it chances. They score, get the ball back, score, get the ball back. This was Notre Dame. I keep saying Notre Dame. I mean, these games are like intertwined in my mind. But Syracuse would score, Massa would win the faceoff. Bryant just could not beat Syracuse 6-on-6. They did not have anyone that could run by the Orange. Colin Dunster had a little bit of success early. Peter McMahon had a little bit of success, but Notre Dame's 6-on-6 defense was superior. Dom Lamalinar made some really critical saves, especially in the second half. And then Bryant started turning the ball over. They turned the ball over 7 times in the first half. I believe it was 11 times in the second half. And that's how the game just kind of got away from them. Also, they gave up 2 huge goals, one with, I think, 3 seconds left in the first quarter. The other was 5 seconds left in the second. You give up goals like that, you turn the ball over in the Carrier Dome, and good things are not going to happen.
Those are momentum goals, and I am a huge, I don't want to say proponent or believer or whatever. If I were a coach, those would drive me crazy, and I think that there are very few coaches who it doesn't drive crazy. The one thing I do want to kind of get your insight on as far as Syracuse going forward. So, you know, you're well familiar with, in your preparation for this game, how the Orange can struggle with a good faceoff guy. And in Yale, their second-round opponent, you know, it seems to me like they might be playing a slightly better version of Bulldogs. You know, Dylan Lovings isn't necessarily a better faceoff guy than Kevin Massa, although he did significantly win that matchup last year. But just all the way across the board, Yale strikes me as a better version of Bryant. Real quick, what are your thoughts on what you saw Sunday night translating into the Orange's second-round matchup?
It's kind of funny, Terry, when you have Syracuse and Yale, I think they're almost looking in the mirror at each other, minus the face-off situation. Now, keep in mind, Syracuse is 8-1 when they lose the face-off battle, so it's not the death knell if they do lose the face-off battle to Dylan Levins and the Yale Bulldogs. The only game they lost this year, when losing the face-off battle, Thomas Kronquist beat them 22-2 at the face-off circle for Villanova. And they only lost that game by one goal. So I don't think that's, you know, it's big, but it's not monumental. I think both Yale and Syracuse have great balance and depth of scoring. When you look at the Orange, Marasco is the headliner, but you've got Tometi, Schoonmaker, Dylan Donahue. You've got Kevin Rice. Hakeem Lecky has 6 goals in his last 5 games. So that they've got balanced scoring. So does Yale. I mean, you talk about Brandon Mangan maybe being their best player, but you have all those scorers that pop up. It's 7 different goal scorers against Penn State. They had, I believe, 9 different goal scorers against Princeton in the Ivy League Tournament Championship game. So depth of scoring. Then you look at the defenses. Michael McCormack, I think, is playing as well as anybody in the country for Yale, and he's joined by Peter Johnson. In Syracuse, you've got McGill and you've got Hamlin and Matt Harris at the poles. So, and both have capable netminders. So I think both these teams, they're kind of looking in the mirror at one another. Syracuse obviously has the experience. And they've got the hunger factor going. I mean, if this senior class doesn't win on Saturday, they'll be the first group of seniors in Syracuse history since 1979 not to make the championship weekend. So I think that's weighing on them a little bit. You know, Yale, are they playing with house money? Maybe. I don't know. They just keep winning elimination games. The game against Penn in the Ivy League tournament semifinal was an elimination, and they won. The championship final against Princeton was elimination, and they won. And they were down 5-1 at halftime and came back and beat Penn State. So I think it's a great game on tap. The face-offs, I think Yale's going to control them, but can Yale handle that Syracuse defense?
Well, Mark Dixon, fantastic breakdown. We appreciate you joining us on the Reflex Podcast for the first time this year, remarkably. Fans that want more from you can follow you at Dixon Lacrosse, and I'm sure that we'll see you on TV a couple more times before the season's out.
Studio this weekend with Anish Schroff, and our special guest is Lehigh coach Kevin Cassis. So make sure you join in.
He's going to make you break it down?
He's going to make me break it down. I'm hoping to get another picture of Coach Cassis getting his makeup done to send out to the Lehigh Nation.
Nice, Mark. Well, enjoy yourself. Have a good one.
Thanks, sir.
And the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast continues with Ryan Flanagan, who is on hand at the Duke Blue Devils double overtime win over the Loyola Greyhounds on Sunday to eliminate the defending national champions from the NCAA tournament, calling the game for ESPNU. And Ryan, I guess, first things first, it was a remarkable game, one that I'm sure a lot of fans are going to remember for a really long time, you know, highlighted by, you know, what was, kind of one of those controversial kick yourself types of decisions, and so far as Charlie Toomey calling timeout with Blake Burkhardt streaking to the goal and ultimately putting one in after the whistle blew. But I guess, you know, in a one goal game between two good athletic teams, there are so many things that you can point to that decided the outcome, but there are also a lot of trends and a lot of things that unfolded that decided the outcome as well. When you think back about this Blue Devil victory, what do you provide the most credit to in terms of allowing Duke to come out on top?
Brendan Fowler. I mean, when you saw the brackets come out, I looked at that game right away and thought that, you know, that's an unbelievable first-round matchup. And then, obviously, Cornell-Maryland, which is a little bit more one-sided than I think a lot of people expected. But if you watched the game last night, I mean, just what Brendan Fowler was able to do at the face-off X, just you look at the numbers. I think the final number was 19-7 in terms of face-offs for Duke. So you look at that. Given the Duke offense the ball that many times and still how close the game was, I think that kind of tells the story right there, that as we went through the game, that Loyola defense just got tired. And Runkle was playing so well that you didn't know how long he was going to be able to hold that up. So, like, really the key there for Duke to be able to pull away towards the end.
I agree. It was actually interesting because I think fatigue is one of the things that is difficult to put a finger on, both for a guy in your position when you're commenting on a game, a guy in my position when you're trying to write a post-game story or whatever. But for whatever reason, it seems so clear yesterday that whether it was Hawkins, and it wasn't as if I thought that, you know, the fouling was a result of his, being tired. But I thought, you know, it wasn't just him. I mean, there were instances where it was like, you know, Reed Acton or Joe Fletcher were trying to carry the ball upfield, and, you know, it's like, is this guy going to be able to beat the ride simply because he's just been playing so much defense? You know, you're a former defender who's played at incredibly high levels, and I'm sure that a time or two you were in a game where you just had a lot of pressure on you. What's it like being a defender and just realizing that, like, we continually have to come back and answer?
Yeah, it wears on you, and that's kind of like you said, you talk about Hawkins, and you watch the first half yesterday versus the second half, and I thought it was two different, totally different games. And just as a defenseman, you're constantly seeing the ball, and you're almost begging your offense, hey, when you get it, try to get a good possession of it and move it around. And I think Loyola tried to do that at times. I just, with the new shot clock rules and how that impacts things, you don't really get an opportunity to take a minute or 2 minutes off the clock. I mean, if you're too patient with the ball, the refs are going to turn the clock on and start that imaginary shot clock. So you really don't get as much as a break, and you're just constantly playing defense, which makes it tough. And then with Fowler, it was make it, take it. So Duke would score in the second half, and Duke would get it right back. So you were just, you could see them grasping for air, and you saw Duke played a little bit more intensity in the second half, and you could tell that those guys are starting to feel it, and you're almost, it's like sand getting through your hands because you can't do anything about it because you know if they score, they're just going to get the ball back. So it's almost a little bit of a hopeless feeling, but again, just it tells how well Loyola's defense was playing that they were able to keep them in that game.
What are your impressions of this stat? Jordan Wolf, Dave Lawson, Jake Trapuka, and Josh Offit combined to take 41 shots, and they scored 5 goals. Those four guys took 41 shots and scored 5 goals. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. I mean, was it just me? I just looked at the box score and saw that, and I'm like, I cannot believe that. But I guess, like, now that I think about it, I mean, the Blue Devils ended up with 61 shots, and they scored 12 goals, and Runkle made 22 saves. I mean, it seems like the math adds up, but Jordan Wolf, 11 shots. Josh Offit, 13 shots. It's crazy.
That's the number. The Offit number is the one that really jumped out at me last night. I was, after the game, just looking at the box score and said, wow, Offit took 13 shots. That's the one that you knew he was being aggressive in the second half, and that was my view during the game, is that you saw the seniors and Wolf start to be a lot more aggressive in the second half. And just as any time that you saw Offit with Hawkins on him or Laconi on him and he could dodge a short stick, he was doing it. And I thought Trapuka did a great job in the second half to get more aggressive and Lawson. And then with Wolf, he was getting decent looks. They weren't great looks. I thought Joe Fletcher did a phenomenal job on him. I think he's got to be the defenseman, the best defenseman in the country right now. Just his ability to force him to spots where he was comfortable. And you saw Wolf a lot of times try to shoot around him and use Fletcher as a screen almost. And he just couldn't get the ball on Cage, which was Joe Fletcher driving him upfield and putting Jordan Wolf in a shot that he wasn't comfortable. So he finished with the 2 goals. I think the first one was almost in transition off of the slide. You saw Fletcher's hedge a little bit towards Trapuka on the wing.
Yeah.
And he did a great job kicking it through.
Yeah, that goal stands out to me because it was early, and it was a goal that I felt like was a very uncharacteristic Loyola defense. This Loyola defensive goal, they don't give up those types of goals. Where I think it was a slide too quick to Hawkins from it, they both it was Fletcher at Acton and Acton from the slot. They both hedged. Neither of them needed to. I didn't think. I think it was Jones that banged it through, and it was like he wasn't beat. There was no slide necessary. I'm with you though. Fletcher had a great game.
I thought he played well, and you see the number. I mean, I think the number from Wolf and those midfielders, I think that can be attributed to how well did they pass it in. I mean, you didn't usually, when you think Duke, you think Dion inside scoring goals in bunches, and he was pretty quiet yesterday because they did a great job covering up the crease, and he couldn't really find much. And then the goals that Case Mathias had, I mean, that last one is more or less in transition, and then he has the one to tie up the game. That's right on the crease. That a great save by Runkle, and it just gives up the rebound, and Case Mathias is right there. So they did a great job covering the crease and forcing Duke to shoot it from the outside.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And then there's one other thing I wanted to address at the other end of the field, and that is that, you know, for all the shots that Duke got, to me, Mike Sawyer is a weapon unlike any other. It's funny because, you know, I was talking to one of my friends about this last night after the game, and I said, well, number one, he can make offensive coordinators look so good because you can run, you know, a really good play, get an open look, you know, take a bad, you know, a bad pass that pulls a guy out of position or something like that, and then you got to reset. You do it all over again, same thing, another good look, just don't get a good shot, whatever. By that I mean, you know, you run good offense, but it just doesn't work out for you. And then you just throw the ball to Sawyer, and he bangs a 17-yard shot home, and it's like, okay, here we go, that's a goal. I think that he has such a unique skill set. It almost reminds me a little bit of what, and I'm big on lacrosse players to basketball player comparisons, and he reminds me of Stephen Curry. But he only took 3 shots. He scored 2 goals. His goals were proto-Mike Sawyer goals, just, you know, unbelievable quick release, putting the ball right on a pipe, but he only had 3 shots. I guess, like, what did that seem like to you? Just not being assertive enough, or did Duke do a good job of taking it out? How do you kind of put your finger on that?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, like, when he's shooting, I mean, it looks almost like he's not putting much effort into it, and the ball just flies out of his stick. It's a quick release, and it's a heavy ball. So, I mean, like you said, he stretches the defense out, but he didn't, I think Duke was mindful of that and was hedging to him. I mean, on the man-up, he had the one man-up goal where he stretched the defense out and shot a low-to-low from about, like, 17 yards that I thought Terry could have had, but just that speaks to the credit of Mike Sawyer to be able to shoot the ball from out there. But I think Duke was mindful of wherever he was. I mean, he wasn't too involved. Like you said, he only had three shots, and they did a little bit of two-man games. They tried to use him in two-man games, but he isn't a Dodger. So, it really, he needs to play off of the other guys. And you saw Butts running a little bit of two-way midfield. So he was off the field a little bit, playing more defense and looking for him in transition. So he wasn't really the one generating an offense. They tried to do a lot through Ward, who had a couple good looks, but I thought Lob and Hips did a really good job covering him and slowing him down. And then Haywire was getting looks inside. So he was getting an opportunity. It just, they didn't really get him involved too much. And then when they tried to get him involved, it was almost like Duke was mindful of him. And like you said, his shots are from the outside from 17 yards. And they couldn't really get the shots where they drive one side and skip it all the way through. I think part of that is just the length of this Duke defense. I mean, they're so long, and they do a good job of getting their sticks in the passing lane. And it's tough because Dupree and Lob and Hips all have the ability to have their stick in your hands wherever you are. So you can't really throw those skip passes all the way across the top of the field. So I think that was part of the reason they took him out of the game, and then just to being mindful of where he was on those man-ups, because there was a ton of penalties in the game.
Yeah, the penalties were something that, you know, I kind of struggle with a little bit, but I thought you and your co-commentator did a nice job of pointing out that there weren't a lot of bad calls. There were just a lot of calls. They made the decision to call the game close, and they continue to do it throughout, and that was kind of, you know, I didn't think that it artificially impacted the result.
No, it wasn't. Like you said, they weren't bad calls. They were, I guess you could say they were soft calls. They were all, I mean, it was a slash, but it wasn't a hard slash. It just, he hit him in the head. It wasn't a hard slash to the helmet, but he did hit him. Or he pushed him. It wasn't a clear, you know, run over his back, but he did push him. So it was, you know, Corey and I talked about it throughout the game of, they are foul, so the refs are doing a good job, and they're calling what's there. It's just, it's a softer game than you're used to. And then I think with Hawkins just plays such a physical style. And I think when you had that Miles Jones matchup and the Dave Lawson matchup, and those ACC midfielders are big guys. I mean, Trapuka's got muscle on him. Lawson's a big, strong guy. And Miles Jones is just a beast. So I think when you put Hawkins in those matchups, he's just going to get even more physical. And I think that's when you get, he used to be on the cross-check somebody once and push him out of the way. But I think what Duke was doing a good job of is they would get into you and then just keep pivoting back and forth and almost cause you to foul. I mean, you saw Ratliff get a hold at 5x5. You saw Hawkins get a hold at 5x5. I think Laconi got a hold down at the 5x5 right on the island. So it was Duke getting to the spots they wanted to get to and then drawing them into fouls. And then in the first half, it was almost the other side of the coin. It was Duke kept getting fouls. I mean, they were getting a push up right on the crease or an interference on the crease on ground balls and stuff, being physical inside. That some games they call it, some games they don't. And I think the game yesterday just, they had everything, and they kept it tight. But like I said, it was all good calls. It was just, I guess, a little bit softer than some people expected. I think the other side of that, with those two teams, I mean, they're both very physical teams, so you almost have to because of the potential of the game getting out of control if you're not in front of that stuff.
Yeah, it's true, and it was interesting, too, because it was one of the first times, you know, in basketball, I think that, you know, a guy like Derrick Rose might make getting fouled a part of his strategy. That's one of the ways he's going to get his points, and I thought that, and it really struck me, I think with 10 minutes ago or 9 minutes ago in the fourth quarter, Bill Connors got called for a hold. I'm pretty sure it was on Hair Wires, and it almost seemed like he was trying to get the foul, and then that was, I think, what led to the Sawyer man-up goal that we were just talking about. But, yeah, I mean, really, you know, this was one of those games that I didn't really want to focus on like any in particular, you know, kind of like aspect of it, because it was just so nuanced and kind of there was so much there that we could continue to talk about. We could talk about it all day, but in the interest of time, let's move on to the other game that you were at least geographically close to as well as familiar with, given the fact that it was your alma mater emerging from what was expected to be a very tough, kind of hard-fought battle against Lehigh and advancing on to play Denver. You know, I wasn't able to see this game yet, and you didn't call it, so I don't want to talk in too much particulars about it, but just based on your familiarity with this Tar Heel team, the one question I want to put to you, because I think you can speak to it pretty well, is that it strikes me that they, and I give a lot of credit to Marcus Holman for this, because as a solo captain and as a guy that I've gotten to know pretty well, I think he understands and has a good handle as far as building this throughout his team. But, like, this Carolina team is uniquely tough. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of, like, I mean, I think you hit it on the head right there. It comes from Marcus Holman. And that's something even when I was there, Coach Bresci preached, and you can't say enough about how good a job Marcus Holman's done this year, not just on the field. I mean, on the field, he's, in my opinion, he's got to be right now, especially with Lyle Thompson being out of the tournament, out of sight, out of mind, with him and Schreiber being out of the tournament. I think it's got to be Pinnell and Marcus Holman with how well both offenses are playing and how big a piece they are of their offenses. I think it's got to be those two in the Thornton conversation. And his impact off the field, I mean, just what he does to motivate those guys. And I talked to Marcus a little bit last week, and they have such a chip on their shoulder, which is great. They're angry almost, and they're playing that way with the toughness you see from Sankey and Bitter and Holman kind of being the leader of that offense and of the team, more or less. Just they don't think they deserve the one seed, but they did everything they could. They went on a streak. They recognize they didn't play too well in the beginning of the year, but they almost feel slighted by getting a five seed, which is great. I mean, I think that's exactly what Carolina needs, because for years we'd have you know, iffy seasons, and we'd end up with a 3 or 4 seed or a 4 or 5 seed. And now they had a great season, number one team in the country at the end of the year, and they're a 5 seed. So I think they have that extra motivation of, hey, let's go out with a chip on our shoulder and prove how well we can be and how well we can play. And like you said, they play tough. I mean, clearing the ball against this team, and in a year where with the shot clock and no horns has really changed the clearing and riding game, they're a team that still rides. And I think they do a really good job of it. And that, again, that hits on their toughness. And then the ability to dodge long balls. I think if you watch Collins lacrosse now, and again, over the past few years, it's been a lot of move the ball and dodge on the short stick D-middy and just keep attacking the D-middies until you get something. But I think they have a little bit different approach where they have no hesitation in sending Bitter and Sankey and Holman against the long balls. And then they're going to keep dodging. And then when you look at the midfield there, who are you going to pull? I mean, everyone's putting their pull on Chad Tutton right now, which is great. Chad is one of the better offensive midfielders in the country. But if you talk to the Carolina coaching staff, they'll tell you that Pontrell is one of the better offensive players on their team. So then you get in the jam of who do you pull, Pontrello or Tutton? And then obviously Davian Mahl on that first midfield inside. So I think they're creating a matchup issue. And then defensively, I think they've simplified things and just – you have one role, cover your guy, keep it simple. So they played much better in the second half of the season. And then R.G. Keenan, I think you heard Coach Bresci say it after the game against Lehigh, and he was a huge piece of the game against Lehigh, just getting that off that Carolina offense the ball. But how well he played, just to give them possession after possession where they can ring up 16 goals. So I think he's going to be the key. I guess looking forward to Denver next week, it's going to be how well R.G. plays.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, obviously the Carrero-Keenan matchup is going to be an interesting one. And you know, you mentioned obviously the fact that the difference is in the type of season. They had a great season and they were a little bit underserved by the committee where, you know, it might have been the other way in the past. But here we are, you know, same matchup 1 year later. And when you look back at this Denver game last year, I mean, it was one of the most exciting games in the NCAA tournament for sure. You know, it was, I think, one of the few times that Carolina felt like maybe offensively they were a little bit back on their heels because of what they were going against offensively at the other end of the field. You know, Denver putting up 42 shots and 16 goals. And obviously, that was a game Jeremy Noble played absolutely out of his mind with 3 goals and 7 assists and, you know, kind of offset a little bit by Marcus's 6 goals and 2 assists. But, you know, it's funny because when coming back to this toughness angle for a second, Lehigh was a team that I think a lot of people talked about over the course of this season as being uniquely tough, and that was a part of their identity. You know, they're a Long Island team in the Lehigh Valley, and they play tough, and, you know, they've got a coach in Kevin Cassis who, you know, is kind of known as a little bit of an Ironman midfielder. So for Carolina to assert its toughness against Lehigh meant something, you know, meant something kind of particular in terms of setting a tone for the game. Now, I think Denver is an interesting team because they have toughness, but it's a different type of toughness. I mean, you know, nobody's going to call, you know, Cam Flynn or Jerry Nobles, these guys that can scrap in the indoor in the summertime, not tough. But it is a little different, and I guess when you think about it from the prospect of, you know, what you think this Carolina team needs to do in order to be successful against Denver, what do you point to?
Face off. I mean, you look at the game last year, like, you know, with what Denver was able to do with Carrero and Noble just continuing to get the ball to that offense and how dangerous they are. Like you said, how well Noble played. I think if Carolina can't win face offs, I mean, they don't need to go 50%. They need to go closer to 60 or 70%, in my opinion, to win just because of how explosive and how efficient the Denver offense is. And like you said, they're tough. They're not going to be intimidated by Carolina at all. They think they're the best offense in the country, and they're going to play with confidence. They know that they can shoot the lights out of the ball. So I think Carolina's going to need to get the ball. I think that was the story last year. Carolina was the home team, the favorite going into the game, and they just couldn't win faceoffs. I think that's the reason why they ended up losing the game. So I think they're only going to go as far as RG goes and how well they do in the, at the faceoff X. But like you hit on it, I mean, it's two tough teams. They're going to scrap a little bit different toughness. Obviously, Denver doesn't have the athleticism that Carolina has at the offensive end of the field, but a ground ball in the middle of the field, they're going to be just as tough. And if they pick it up, they're going to have the same opportunity that Carolina would have to score on the other end of the field, if not a better opportunity, just because of how well they shoot the ball. But I think the key is going to be faceoffs. I mean, LaPlante and Kieran Burke, I think, and Faust, they're going to be good goalie play, but I think it's not going to be that's not going to be a determining factor. I think the determining factor is going to be who has the ball more, which is going to be a play on the faceoffs.
Last year, Chase Carrera, 22 of 30 with 17 ground balls. Unbelievable game, and certainly, like you said, a matchup to look forward to, and a lot different, too. I mean, you know, since RG has had his, you know, kind of midseason struggles, he's played a little bit more consistently. And at the other end, you know, Chase is really, I mean, I talked to him about it a couple times at different points this season. You know, his knee injury changed his style. You know, now he's a knee-down guy, isn't necessarily as focused on getting out the front door as quickly. So, you know, who knows? It'll be a different matchup. For as much as it's the same two guys going head-to-head, it'll be a little bit of a different matchup than what we saw last year. So, Ryan, thank you for joining us on the Reflux Podcast. We appreciate your support throughout the season. It's great to finally be able to talk to you. Nice job on a game that I'm sure will get played a couple of times on ESPN Classic, or at least in the homes of Duke fans over the course of the next couple of weeks. And good luck as the rest of the tournament moves on.
Thank you. That's going to be, like you said, that'll be a game that a lot of people watch. And this weekend with Carolina and Denver, that'll be another good one. I think, like you said, the knee down on the faceoffs is going to be a point to watch. That's, RG struggled with that with RG Keen, with Fowler. Duke, he's a knee down guy as well, and you've seen those battles. So I'm interested to see how that works out now that you mentioned that. But thanks for having me. Always a pleasure, and look forward to hearing what you got to say next week.
Inside the Cross Podcast.